Portland.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kabu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
There's something missing and I'm lit and I got something to say.
Good evening, you're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. Tonight we're going to be talking with author Lucy Sant. Lucy is an author and is a transgender woman, and we're going to be talking tonight about some of Lucy's books, about her transition, about life, what is life like for her now after transition, and just anything else that we can think of. So, Lucy, welcome to Transpositive. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I was born in 1954. I'm 70. I was born in Verviers, Belgium, which is the Belgian Rust Belt, and the industry collapsed at the end of the 50s. So my parents and I wound up emigrating to the United States. We actually flipped back and forth between countries for a few years because my mother hated it here. My father loved it. It's complicated. And let's see. So I grew up in suburban New Jersey after that. And then I got a scholarship to a Jesuit high school in New York City. And then I got a scholarship to Columbia. And I went there, made a bunch of friends, eventually moved to the Lower East Side, where I lived until the early 90s, moved to Brooklyn, and I've been living up here in the Hudson River Valley since 2000, when I got a job teaching at Bard College, from which I retired 2 years ago. And I've written, I think, 11 books, especially in the past when there were magazines, I wrote for a zillion magazines. I've written about cities. I've written a lot about photography. I've written two memoirs. And according to two different people, I am the only person so far to have written memoirs in each gender. And I have a wide range of interests. Right now, I have a Substack, which is kind of like trying to figure out if I can write a book about writing. And I'm also writing a book about the Velvet Underground in New York City in the 1960s.
Well, there's a lot there we can talk about, that's for sure. That's great. So thanks for... So, lots of good stuff. So first of all, could you just... could you start, though, first by maybe just telling us a little bit about yourself and also about your coming out story?
Yeah, sure. I kind of knew I was trans around age 9 or 10. But you have to understand this was taking place in a complete vacuum. Because for one thing, you know, I grew up essentially in the 1930s, because it was post-war Europe. Nobody had central heating. Nobody had cars, you know, stuff like that. And so for me, the plunge into the modern world was more complicated for many people. And for that matter, I was an only child. And especially after we moved to the United States, we were isolated. There weren't any other Belgians. I did not know any girls until I was in my mid-teens at all. And the idea of transgender people, you know, eventually I read about Christine Jorgensen when I was a teenager. But, you know, but that was like some, you know, Loch Ness monster kind of unique occurrence. And then, you know, as I grew up, I mean, I can tell, like, from, I had to do this re-examination of my life to write this book, and I could tell that, you know, when I was a teenager and in my 20s, my trans identity was very close to the surface. And then I became an adult and focused on career. I got married twice. I have a son who's now 25. You know, I became an adult and tried to stifle myself altogether, basically become a work machine and nothing else. And, you know, I mean, even after I figured out that I was transgender, what transgender was, I was so ignorant because, you know, wasn't a lot of information. Believe me, you had to really dig for it. And I was afraid to dig for it because then people would find out, even if they were complete strangers. And I didn't know about things like hormones until the internet. And I got on the internet in 1997. I was already then 43 years old. And then even after that, I had the problem that I'm almost 4 years into my transition. I did not do the gender switch. I did not start getting attracted to men. I've always been attracted to women, cis women, trans women, you know, women. The other thing was that back then too, I mean, I realized that part of what was holding me back was my ambition. I wanted to be a famous writer. That's an oxymoron right there. Famous writer, like jumbo shrimp. I wanted to be a famous writer. And I figured if I were transgender, the best I could hope for was to get assigned the weirdo desk. You know, I mean, the fact is that I remember like living on the Upper West Side in the mid 1970s. When Broadway was lined with SRO hotels. And that's where I saw most trans women, including an entire doo-wop group on a Broadway and 100th Street coming out of the Whitehall Hotel. They'd probably been a male doo-wop group sometime in the past, and here they were in bouffants and cocktail dresses. It was amazing. But, you know, you could tell these people were living on welfare and, you know, probably drug addicts. I mean, you know, inevitably eating badly, drinking too much, getting themselves murdered, for God's sakes. That's not a life I wanted. I didn't, and even if conditions had been better, I did not want my life to be determined by my gender. You know, I did not want to be a professional trans person. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was almost the only way you could do it. You know, the examples, I mean, sure, there were great examples. Wendy Carlos, you know, Renee Richards, I mean, Jan Morris, you know, but they became professionally transgendered. It was, you know, it was impossible to avoid. And I wanted to, first of all, be me, you know, singularly me, because of partly because of the sort of vacuum I come from, you know, mm-hmm. this profound isolation. So when I did transition, it was in February, so it was almost 4 years, February 21, middle of the month, and it happened by way of, and this will be a familiar story to many of you, it happened by way of FaceApp. I I took a picture, ran through FaceApp, and wowie zowie. And then I was immediately moved to put every snapshot, every school portrait, everything I had of myself through FaceApp. And that gave me the panorama of my life as it might have been. Mm-hmm. And that's what broke my egg, cracked my finally after... Mm-hmm. You know, almost 60 years, for heaven's sakes. And then it was kind of like this gigantic volcanic eruption. I mean, it lasted 2 weeks, but it was like one day, you know, to me. I came out to my shrink. I came out to my partner, who eventually did leave me because she didn't want to be with a woman. Came out to my son. I came out to about 30 of my friends, and then came out to more and more people, and eventually came out on Instagram. And then I got the opportunity to write a piece for Vanity Fair and came out that way. And then I wrote this book, I Heard Her Call My Name, which came out last February. And it's the story of my life and the story of my coming out. It juggles these two very different time frames by interleaving them. And it was an incredible exercise. I mean, it was like the most fun I've ever had writing. I wrote it in about 2 months while doing a whole bunch of other stuff. So it was just pouring out of me. I mean, it's the only time in my life I've ever gotten up in the morning and immediately started to write.
Mm-hmm.
So here I am, a professional trans person. And well, let's see. I mean, it's been good. I mean, I realize, I mean, it's impossible to overcome the oceanic feeling of regret that I didn't do this years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, I never got a chance to be a pretty girl. I never had a chance to be a middle-aged woman. All I get to be is this crone. And that's heartbreaking, you know, especially since, like, I apparently have zero sex appeal, you know, like none. I've never felt any waves coming off anybody else. And I'm pretty isolated. I live, you know, I have a house. I live here by myself in a town where I don't really know people, even though I've been here for 17 years. Mm-hmm. And I barely know any trans people. I mean, I know a few, but, you know, they're leading their own lives. The people I'm closest to are actually much younger people, and we don't talk that much because they're young, you know, they're doing shit. And the older trans people I know, many of them have problems, you know, or like, I don't know, it's very strange because one thing that cis people don't realize, among the many things they don't realize about trans people, is that we are such a, you know, global federation. I mean, trans people come out of not only every, you know, race, creed, color, national origin, but every walk of life, every rung on the economic ladder. It's mm-hmm. absolutely, it's almost like a random scattering through the human population. I was thinking of writing something fairly short. I don't know how I disseminated. I wanted to write, like, basically, because I haven't seen this, you know, just like things I would like my cis friends to know, things that cis people should know about trans people that they probably have no idea.
Like what? Could you give some examples?
Well, I mean, for example, what I just mentioned, but simply the fact that being trans is not a choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a psychological condition. It comes from your body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm illiterate in science speak anyway, but I have not heard any reference to any scientific studies being done on this, you know? Oh gosh, I mean, I'm can't think of the whole outline of the.
Sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot. Yeah.
But there's a lot. And, you know, being my age, I'm coming out of cis culture. I mean, 99% of the people I know are cis. Many of them mean very well. I didn't lose a single friend from coming out. And that was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, you know? So, I mean, I'm even though I feel isolated, all that, I got to say, I'm pretty sheltered, you know? I mean, I lived in New York City for 30 years, and I've been up here in the Hudson River Valley for 20 years. And both those places are intensely blue, or New York City was more so when I was there. But in any case, kind of a lot of people have my back, you know? You know, and but nevertheless, they're ignorant. I think a lot of cis people are consciously or not frightened of the subject. It's they feel themselves when they approach the subject like standing on the brink of a cliff, and if you wobble, you might go over.
So I have a question for you. My question is, do you think that cisgender people have a responsibility to understand what it means to be transgender? Do they have a responsibility to try to understand something about us?
Yes. I mean, I think they have at least the responsibility of an elementary understanding. You know, I think everybody does. It's the way, you know, you have a responsibility to... You don't have to know about, like, you know, the intimate mores of some country in another continent that you'll never visit. But if the inhabitants of that country come to live in your neighborhood, you kind of have to know a little bit. It's the same thing.
Sure.
Every cis person is going to encounter trans people these days, sometimes without knowing it. And they do have a responsibility to know that, no, this is not costume. This is not drag. This is not a fetish. This is, you know, this is something that I don't understand because I can't experience it. But on the other hand, you know, here's what trans people have explained about the process. And
I was just asking because, I mean, yesterday I interviewed a friend, someone who's transgender, and they had filed an amicus brief before the Supreme Court. It was part of the Scrimeti case, the case that's still being deliberated by the Supreme Court, and hopefully they'll rule in our favor, although I really doubt it, obviously. We all know they're going to rule against us, but you know, the Scrimeti case is basically the second really landmark case before the Supreme Court about the rights of transgender people, and this is a case about transgender teens and whether transgender teens deserve you know, gender appropriate care. I mean, and if you look at what's been going on in the United States this last year, you know, there's literally been hundreds of pieces of legislation filed against transgender people in states all around the country, even as extreme as in Texas, where they, you know, one lawmaker filed a bill, which probably isn't going to go anywhere, but says that transgender people are committing identity fraud, and that they could be arrested with and charged with a felony for presenting fraudulent documents to any public official that says that their gender isn't the gender that was assigned to them on their birth certificate. Anyways, my question is, I mean, you know, that was kind of the context of my question. Like, you know, a lot of this is just profound ignorance. Just a really profound ignorance of what transgender people are and what our issues are. So could you comment on any part of that? Just, you know, and anything?
I mean, certainly if they're going to pass any kind of law, they should be able to pass, you know, a 50 question quiz. You know, really, I mean, people who, especially people who have legal standing to argue, lawyers, judges, they should definitely be educated. Actually, the most chilling thing, and I only read this in passing, I don't have any details, I just read this yesterday, it was chilled me to the bone, that Florida is mandating forced detransitioning for transgender prisoners.
Well, don't get arrested in Florida then. I guess that's kind of the the moral of the story. You know, don't even go to Florida, apparently. I don't know. I'm on the West Coast, you know, so Hawaii is a lot closer. But it's so easy to go to Key West. I mean, who doesn't love Key West? I love Key West. I mean, it's been a while since I've been there, but oh, it's so beautiful. I just love that drive down to Key West, and it's part of the Continental 48, but oh my goodness, Florida, what a mess. Anyways, yeah, I'd like to talk about your two books now, if we could, for a little while. I'd like to talk about your books. Specifically, I'd like to talk about the two books that you wrote. You wrote one memoir as a man, and then years later, when you transitioned, you wrote another memoir as a woman. So could we start, could you talk about those books?
So The Factory of Facts, which was published in 1997, that was my attempt to situate myself. That is, you know, I'm a weirdo. I come from, like, you know, okay, when I was in fourth grade, fifth grade, maybe, there was a substitute teacher one day, and I had an accent, you know, I didn't lose it until I was a teenager. And where are you from? And I said, Belgium. And she said, oh, class, admire this brave little boy who comes from a country that's half communist and half free. You know, so people are so ignorant about everything. Right? And this is a teacher, for God's sake. So I wanted to, and but even as I, you know, I hardly ever met any other Belgians. And when I did, they were Flemish generally. Very, very few Walloons were ever seen outside Wallonia. So I wanted to write a book situating myself. I didn't know anything about the history of my family because we were working class, you know, and I had some documents going back to my great-grandfather, and that's it. But it turns out that we're like in the first local census. My family was living in the town where I was born 800 years ago, meaning probably much more than that. Anyway, and then immigration, you know, and the language, the history of my city, which, for example, was the site of the last Congress of the International Working Men's Association, the first international back. Well, this is after the Marx-Bakunin split. So this was the anarchist international in my hometown in, and it, at a date where I figured out that my great grandfather might well have been there. You know, so it's not really about me, except it's all about me, but I'm not that much of a character in the book. You know, because it's all about the past, and it's about these rings of association and movement of peoples and all this kind of stuff. And I realize now that, you know, in part, I wasn't going to write a book that was, you know, about me because I didn't want to be seen. I wanted to, you know, to me, I constructed this authorial persona that I put into the spotlight. And that's what I wanted people to see. Not the little wizened character behind it operating the strings, you know, didn't want to see that. And so my second memoir covers, you know, some of the same territories. I'm sure I haven't reread the first one in quite a long time. So I'm sure that there are some stories repeated from one to the other, although the Factory of Facts is very expansive. I mean, I think when I have looked at it, I've wanted to take a scalpel because I'm very much about compression now. And indeed, I heard her call my name is very compressed, and it's down to the bone. There's not a lot of fancy writing in it, so well, it's still written, but so it tells. So as much as my life is covered in the Factory of Facts, anyway, it only goes up to age 10 or something like that. This one takes it from, from the cradle, and shows, talks about my family in ways I couldn't do in the first book because my parents were still alive. Now my son is my only relative. Everybody's dead. So I can say whatever I want. I didn't want to upset my parents. And I was really writing the first book for my father, who got dementia before he could read it, which is kind of hard. And for this book, it goes all the way to the present. Talks about my youth and the Lower East Side and all this stuff, and skips lightly over my two marriages because I didn't want to start any wars, talks about all my friends, and I have an awful lot of friends now who I've known for 50 or more years. Yeah, so we're all old, which is so weird. I never expected to get anywhere near this age. I've only outlived my oldest grandparent. But then my grandparents were subject to poor people's medicine in pre-war Europe,
It sounds like your two memoirs really, how do I say this? It's like they're sort of a continuation. I mean, it's your memoirs are about the same person. It's just like your different experiences of your body as that person, but it sounds like they follow each other really well.
Another of the paradoxes of being transgender is that almost every day, after 4 years, almost every day, I'm like astonished that I'm here, that it happened. And at the same time, it feels so natural. It almost feels like I've been trans, actively trans all my life. It's somehow both of those things coexist. It's so weird.
How did your son react to your coming out? What was his reaction?
He's totally chill because he's that generation. His favorite extracurricular activity when he was in high school was LARPing, live action role playing. And that
Oh,
brought
yeah.
out all the transgender kids. And he went to, for years, he went to Wood School in Woodstock, New York. So, there were trans kids plenty there, mostly female to male. And actually, well, I won't go into that, but he's been consistently very good with me. He's fine. We get along great.
What about your ex-wives? How did your transition go with them? Are you in communication with them? How did that go?
It was very difficult for me for the first maybe 2 years. I mean, we tried two bouts of couples therapy that I flunked because I couldn't stop crying. I have a hard time not being partnered. It's very weird now not to have no one for like 2 years because I'd been almost continuously partnered for 50 years before that. A whole bunch of different people, but continuously. But her, Mimi, we've now known each other for 18 years. And We're still very close. I mean, we share a dog. She comes here and stays a lot. And when I'm in the city, I stay at her place. We're still a gigantic part of each other's lives. But she was no longer attracted to me when I became a woman, and she's that's just I understand it, I had a girlfriend eons ago who was kind of she never got to the point of thinking about being trans, I think, but she was definitely dressing butch, and that made me not uncomfortable, but I wasn't as attracted, so I understand.
So I have kind of a long question for you. I mean, well, let me put it this way. It's a long way to get to my question that I've got for you. And it kind of starts here. It starts with our conversation we're having right now. Like you and I mean, I'm a lot closer to your age than I am to, like, for instance, your son's age. I'm much, much closer to your age. And, I mean, I think just based on listening to our conversation so far, like, I think that you and I were both raised in the era of the gender binary, where, there was just kind of this understanding. I mean, there was like two genders. There was men and there was women. And so if you were transgender, that meant that you transitioned your gender and you went from being a man to being a woman. So, I mean, that's kind of what I understood. But nowadays, it seems like the next generation that came along really started to kind of like reconstruct gender and deconstruct gender. And, like I think there's a group in Portland. I think they're called the Anti-Binary Collective or something like that. I can't remember exactly what their name is, but, they're like these younger queer people, and they're just like, they're totally deconstructing everything about gender. They're basically saying there is no gender. Any kind of gender norm is like fundamentally a root of oppression. And the thing to do with gender is to just radically deconstruct gender. So, I mean, you hear people saying, I'm male, female, non-binary. And I think these people would say that they're anti-binary, although I'm not sure about that. They might just say they're non-binary. But anyways, the point is, I mean, when I started doing the show, like we started having people come on the show and they'd be like, well, I'm non-binary. And so now non-binary is like this whole thing. I mean, non-binary is actually the biggest thing there is. I mean, in the community is non-binary. And, non-binary people say, well, I don't have a binary. It's like, and that's a real challenge to us, That's a real challenge to us because, I mean, for us, we came from a generation where, like, if you were transgender and you transitioned your gender from male to female, like we both have, that's like a really big deal. I mean, that's like this really radical thing, and it's considered kind of dangerous, and, but it's also like totally liberating. And like, here we are, like, we're transitioning our genders, and we think that this is this big deal. But in the meantime, the ground has totally shifted underneath us, and all of these younger queer people are like just completely deconstructing gender. Now they're saying that they're non-binary and they're anti-binary. So what do you say about all that?
Right.
What do you think? What do you think of that?
I mean, they're the avant-garde, and they may well triumph someday. And every generation, when they get to a certain point in their lives, they look at the avant-garde, and it's like William Butler Yeats seeing Alfred Jarry, seeing Ubu on stage and saying, "After us, the savage god." It's like, that's cool. Theoretically, I get it. Emotionally, I will never be there. And that's partly because, what happened is that, you know, we're ducklings, we imprint. You can tell my whole style is because I imprinted on Françoise Hardy and Jean Shrimpton and Marianne Faithfull when I was about the age when I figured out that I was trans, you know? That's just it for me, you know? That's my sweet spot. And no amount of theoretical discursions on the meaning of gender is ever going to change this emotional core that I have, you know, which I came by just by being alive at a certain time, you know? It's, you know, I mean, just as our lives would be inexplicable to somebody in the 19th century, I mean, things change, humans change. And so far, we are the longest existent, you know, taboo minority to have emerged. I mean, more taboo than really anything else. Although, well, anyway, it's, you know, the reason, I mean, yes, obviously I'm deeply upset by anti-trans legislation, but I'm so used to cis people not getting it because unless you have actual discourse with trans people, you're not going to know about it, really. You know, it's like for me, and well, here's another interesting thing that was going on in my mind when you were talking before, which is that when I was living on the Lower East Side, I lived there from 78 to 92. And around the middle of that period is when a lot of trans stuff was happening around the Pyramid Club and Club 57. And I didn't go there, partly because I was afraid, right? Obviously. I mean, I lived literally half a block from the Pyramid Club and my office was there. Also because it was, I felt, you know, I didn't feel like I was on the same wavelength because it was an outgrowth of like gay male culture, the way I saw it. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of gay male friends, right? I mean, of all kinds. I knew some who went to the leather bars and I knew others who were like very buttoned up and stuck to the uptown gay bars and stuff. You know, it was a whole like the spectrum of gay experience is something I visited when I was in the 70s, but I did not feel part of it. You know, I had great sympathy and love for my friends, but I was not there. And I still, in a lot of ways, I mean, drag is something I've never quite understood. You know, and I've known gay practitioners and they're, you know, people who are really great. But like, okay, if you're not going to be it, why are you doing it? You know, I don't know. That's the limits of my ability to emotionally navigate that terrain, you know, and it just shows my age, really, nothing else. I mean, it's not for lack of will, it's for, you know, it's for being in a different place. I don't know how to say it, but in any case, I will defend their right to destroy gender all they want. I mean, more power to them, you know. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question for you. It's a few minutes back, you mentioned a line from a play that had the word ubu in it. And I almost never hear anyone use that word ubu. It's a great word. I love the word ubu. Anyways, but my connection with the word ubu is actually ubu web, which is ubu web is this curated website of mostly like avant-garde art from like the 1950s through about the 2010s. It's this really interesting kind of, it's got this weird sort of public domain feel to it, and it's also got this sort of like curated museum feel to it. It's really interesting. Do you know anything about that website? And what is the story of Ubu?
Sure. It's a play written by Alfred Jarry that dates from the end of the 19th century and is originally based on something he wrote when he was in high school. It was like a farce making fun of one of his teachers, who was this round figure who was very unpleasant and very certain of that he knew everything and was more ignorant than any of his students. And this evolved into this kind of mythic character, King Ubu. And there are three plays. And the first one, when it opened in Paris, finally, like on a professional stage in, like, I forget what year, 1905, 1907, something like that, it caused this enormous scandal because, you know, French theater was still very, like, all about Alexandrines and flowing lines and correct grammar. And Ubu comes out on stage and his first word is merde. And it became like the signal throwdown of what the avant-garde was going to be in the 20th century. It was going to be confrontational. It was going to be ludic. It was going to be funny. And it's going to thumb its nose at all of society, you know, that kind of thing. And Ubu Web is this amazing thing, which really is like an artifact of the early internet that's still going. Kenny Goldsmith has funded this thing and is basically downloading every motion picture, sound recording, et cetera, of avant-garde activity as far back as he can go. It features my favorite Patti Smith performance of all time, which is called Parade, which is from a thing she did at one of the St. Mark's Poetry Marathons in the mid-70s. It's fantastic. And young people who never... because it's not really represented on her records, the way she was spontaneous, the way she was funny, and the way she was totally wild in those days. It's something to hear. Mm-hmm. So that's Ubu in a way.
In
a nutshell.
When I was first looking for Ubu Web, it's because I was looking for the film Flaming Creatures, the 1963 film, and that's where I found it. What do you think of that? Have you seen Flaming Creatures?
Oh, well, it's crazy. I mean, it's like this is happening before Warhol. You know, this is I'm writing a book right now, as I mentioned, about the Velvet Underground in the 60s. So I'm writing about Jack Smith, who was a remarkable character, kind of a walking cartoon, amazing, weird guy, exotic landlordism of the world. And Flaming Creatures, along with, like, you know, people were making The Flower Thief and The Flower Thief by Ron Rice, Blonde Cobra by Ken Jacobs, all these movies that are the Kushar brothers a bit later, all these movies that are camp, but they're not just camp. There's something much crazier than mere camp going on there, you know, and profoundly destabilizing. And, you know, Flaming Creatures was, like, for years and years and years, the test case, even more than, like, Naked Lunch. It was the place beyond which no traveler dare sail, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and featured some of the illustrious drag queens of the Lower East Side, you know, mm-hmm. Mario Montez, etc.
So let's talk about drag queens for a minute. I mean, this is an ongoing conversation in the transgender community. And I mean, how do you relate to drag queens as a transgender woman?
You know, that's a funny thing. I mean, look, it's the codes in gay culture that I've never quite understood. And drag is one facet of that, you know. There are, looks, you know, there's the very tidy English schoolboy look, which to me, I mean, that's drag, you know. I mean, all these looks are like, so, I mean, there's drag among straight cis people too, like bikers, you know. And I don't really get that either, you know. It's the same kind of thing, really.
So is it mostly sartorial? Is that it?
Well, sartorial behavioral, because if you dress like a biker, you're also going to drink like a biker and probably throw chairs like a biker and slap your girlfriend around like a biker, etc. You know, and it's like when I encounter various kinds of drag, I kind of feel like I'm in a foreign country. I need a guidebook. Like, because there's illusions I'm not getting, you know. In a way, I mean, the old drag was easier to understand because, oh yeah, that's Bette Davis. And you know, I mean, you read, have you read Cynthia Carr's amazing biography of Candy Darling?
No, but I interviewed, but we actually had someone on recently talking about it.
It's an incredible book, but you know, that's Candy, like, operated like, you know, okay, today I'm going to be Kim Novak in something, you know, like specific movie references. That I can understand because I've seen all those movies. And I'm also kind of not that much younger, really. And references in younger gay culture today, I'm not always getting. I mean, I don't know. I'm just thinking, I've been, because, well, my former partner has been here this week, and one thing we do together is watch Project Runway, and there's all kinds of display behavior going on there that I don't necessarily know how to interpret, you know?
So, how did your friends react to your coming out? Yeah, could you talk about that? We've talked about how your family reacted and also about your memoir, but you said some of your friends you've known for a long time. How did they react to your coming out? Tell me about that.
By and large, it was like, you know, when I sent out the first letter, everybody was like, go for it, yay, had no idea, but wow, you know, et cetera. And then after that, I mean, ever since, and it used to bother me a lot, nobody ever makes reference to it. You know, I'm still the same person. And in a way, that means that I kind of fall into certain kind of male behaviors that I thought had gone away. You know, I mean, nothing dramatic or anything, but just internal feelings more. Yeah, nobody ever asked, like, well, how's the transition going? I think partly because they're afraid to, and I think that's partly because the ones who are like more with it, who might have the questions, the problem there is that they're afraid of offending. Like, you know, they heard somewhere that you're not supposed to ask about the dead name and junk like that. I mean, with me, I don't care. You know, I'm always saying, you know, I hope my dead name doesn't die until we sell off the back stock, you know.
Sorry.
But you know, yeah, I would really welcome people to ask me questions, including the embarrassing ones. You know, I'm perfectly willing to talk about why I'm not getting surgeries. You know, well, it really comes down to because I'm too old, sadly. But you know, I mean, I will field any questions. I guarantee to be unoffendable. You know, but my friends, you know, they're nice people, but they are far from my particular reality on this subject, you know.
You know, I mean, I really think that with some of these people, it's just that it's like, well, we're happy you're transgender. That's nice. I mean, they don't really care that much about the fact that we're transgender because it's just we're another person in their life and we're part of their community already. So being transgender doesn't really matter.
Basically, yeah. You know, I mean, with some of these people, we've been through the wars together. And the fact is, you know, I know that I've always been a weirdo, you know? I mean, we're all weirdos in a way, because 99% of my friends are artists of one kind or another. But I've always been, I don't know, I mean, I just got this kind of image of myself the other day talking to Mimi, my ex. Nobody had ever told me this before. She said, because I was like complaining about a picture somebody had taken of me at a reading, and she said, well, you know, you have this way of talking where your mouth is moving as if you were making French vowels, even if though you're speaking English. Your mouth does not look like it's speaking English. And also, when you're reading, you have a tendency to jut out your chin, which is a very Gallic move. And holy cow, I mean, I had never known this about myself. It's causing me to have to rethink how I'm gonna, you know. But anyway, you know, I mean, people know stuff about us that we don't know. I mean, I did get a bunch of responses to my coming out letter from all women, mind you, saying surprised but not surprised, you know, mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
And in general, by and large, you know, women have been great. Men, some of the men have been great too, but it's calming down now. But for quite a while, I could sense actual fear coming off mm-hmm. some of the men.
So looking ahead, Lucy, what's ahead for you in your future? You said you're working on a book right now about the Velvet Underground.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, it's a long story, but I started out with a contract for a biography of Lou Reed and discovered I didn't want to do it and swapped it out for a two-book contract. And the first book was my memoir, and the second book, because I had to retain a connection to Lou, is about the Velvet Underground in their time.
And what about for you in your personal life as a transgender woman? What's ahead for you?
You know, I'm going to, because even though I'm, you know, well into my golden years, I'm incorrigibly romantic, and I'm going to keep trying, looking for love, even though it's unlikely to come.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much the size of it. And, you know, I've never, ever, ever in my life wanted to be a spokesperson for anything, but I will definitely do my part in these coming dark years, you know, anything I can do. Not quite sure what that would be, except, you know, first of all, I did write this book. And by the way, this most negative criticisms I've gotten on this book, well, I got one from a clearly TERF reviewer at the TLS, the Times Literary Supplement in London, and the British are hostile in general. But in America, the only negative reviews I've gotten have been from people deep within the trans community who are measuring me on some kind of scale where basically, you know, if you're not writing for the trans community, what are you even doing? And yeah, I wrote it for people like me who might be thinking about it or might not know. And I wrote it for parents of trans kids, of whom I probably know more parents of trans kids than I do trans people, to tell you the truth. There's a lot of them out there. And I also wrote it for, you know, my cis friends to kind of get an idea, you know, make them understand. From what I've heard, you know, I mean, people have learned from my book, so I'm happy about that. It's done well enough, you know, it's been on a lot of top 10 lists at the end of the year. It was even on CBS This Morning last week. I hope it'll bring a lot of, you know, readers out there who need to know.
So, at this point in your career, I mean, you're releasing this new book, but at this point in your career, do you have any concerns about, being pegged as a transgender writer? I mean, you've written about a lot of things in your life, and being transgender is only part of like your legacy as a writer, but this sometimes happens to people when they start writing about transition, like you sort of get pegged as a trans writer and people don't remember the other stuff that you did.
That's already happened to me so many times in different guises. I wrote about a book about New York, and for a decade I was the New York guy. I resurrected a famous book on con artists, and for a while I was getting all requests to write about con artists. On and on, really. I've written about photography, so I'm also the photography person. Some of these things last for a season. Sometimes they're like continuous. I just add another name tag on my hat. That's cool. I'm a trans writer. I've also written these 10 other books, and we'll write more, I hope. You can try to pin me down, but you won't be able to for very long,
Sorry,
I'm sorry.
please finish.
Oh, I was going to say also, and this is important to me, I avoid the jargon. Too much trans writing is drowning in jargon, and too much of that jargon began in like seminar rooms. This has to stop. People have to resort to plain English and, not like necessarily delineating every fine delineation when you're merely in conversation. People have just got to go back and read, and I don't mean read academic texts. I mean read like good literature for one thing. Simplify your thoughts. So anyway, that's the end of my sermon.
Well, Lucy, it's been a real pleasure having you on Transpositive. Thank you so much for joining us. If you could let us know where people can find you online, and also if you could just remind us again about your second book, that'd be great.
Okay, my website is lucysante.com, LucySante.com. On Instagram, I'm LuxxAnte. And my book is called I Heard Her Call My Name. It's about to come out in paperback, I think this month. Available wherever fine books are sold. Even, the horrible insectoid mega realtor re retailer that is funding Trump right now hasn't yet been banned as far as I know. Maybe it will, who knows, probably, at some point. And that's about it, I guess.
Well, Lucy, thanks so much for joining us tonight on Transpositive.
Thanks for inviting me. Have a great day, Emma.
Thank you.
Listening to KBOO Port.
Welcome to KBOO. I want to see you grow.
Welcome to KBOO. I'm Michael Van Cleek, Vice President of the KBOO Board of Directors. Are you passionate?